The Shortcode Podcast is a proud member of the MedEd Media Network. Inspiration, information, and guidance on your journey to medical school and beyond at mededmedia.com.
Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Shortcode Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues and interviews
by students for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcoat.com.
Welcome back to the Shortcoat Podcast, a production of the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. I'm Amanda Manrot, an M2 here. I'm here with fellow M2s, Tony Mai, Hadil Ayub, and Brian Wall, all from Student Physicians for Human Rights. We're hosting Dr. Mark Schreim, an assistant professor of otolaryngology and of global health and social medicine at the Harvard Medical School. He serves as the research director at the program in global surgery and social change. His academic pursuits focus on surgical delivery in low and middle income countries, where he has a specific interest in the intersection of health and impoverishment. His work aims to determine optimal policies and platforms for surgical delivery that maximize health benefits while simultaneously minimizing the risk of financial catastrophe faced by patients. To date, he has worked and taught in Liberia, Sierra Leone, Guinea, Benin, Togo, Congo, Haiti, Saudi Arabia, Cameroon, and Madagascar. When not working, he is an avid photographer and rock climber, and has competed on seasons 8 and 9 of American Ninja Warrior.
What's that like, American Ninja Warrior?
It's the best experience I've had. You know, I got into this through a fit of sheer hubris. I was watching the show one day, and I'd been a rock climber for 7 years at that point. I was watching the show one day, and I thought, I can do this. So I signed up. I talked to a friend of mine who had done it, put together a video, filled out the 8-page application that they make you fill out, and then completely forgot about it because they get 75,000 applications every year. And I thought, there's no way they're going to take a nerdy 41-year-old doctor from Boston. So continued climbing, continued doing my thing, and just kind of forgot that this happened until I got a call a few months later from from one of the junior producers, who said she liked the video, she was interested in what I showed, but she had two requests. One, I needed to show a little bit more athletics in my video. But two, she said, you're kind of boring. She literally did say this, and she's like, I want you to jazz it up a little bit, and then I can send it up to the producer. So I did, jazz it up a little bit.
Starts spitting out medical facts in the middle of your routine.
Yeah, yeah.
Wait, can we know what the video was in the first place?
No.
It's been mysterious.
it does not exist on YouTube.
Oh, we looked.
So I sent it back, and at that point I thought, this is six weeks before they were taping. And I thought, all right, there's actually a chance I get on this, so I should probably go practice for this. I went to a gym that has obstacles, thinking again, right? I'm a climber. I've got decent upper body strength. Couldn't do a single thing. It was the most terrifying 6 weeks of my life. But I competed in Philadelphia in 2008, in season 8, and it was amazing. I loved it, and it's become sort of what I do. I've got my official life, and then everything else is Ninja Warrior.
Between medicine and climbing, sounds like you do a lot of traveling.
Yeah, quite a lot.
So what brings you here to the Carver College of Medicine today?
So I've been invited by the Department of Otolaryngology, the Department of ENT, to give a couple of lectures on global health broadly, global surgery in specific, the research that's been done over the last couple of years in the delivery of surgery in low and middle income countries.
I guess for the medical students out there listening, could you tell us a little bit about what you were like in medical school?
Yeah. So I never wanted to be a doctor. I am the firstborn son of an immigrant family. And so, you know, I actually wanted to be a linguist. And if I didn't want to be a linguist, then I wanted to be a rock star, because what little boy doesn't want to be a rock star? And if I didn't want to be a rock star, then I wanted to be a philosopher, because what little boy doesn't want to be a philosopher? But my dad had other thoughts. And the only three options available to me were medicine, the law, or business. And I liked science, and so I majored in biology in college and then followed 95% of the graduating students from my biology program into medicine. And I hated every single minute of it. I tried to quit so many times. I took a year off after my first year, went to live in Singapore, taught organic chemistry in Singapore, loved it there. Found myself as the sort of as the year was waning, found myself walking myself to the immigration building in Singapore, fully intending to apply for permanent residency in Singapore.
It's like dropping out of medical school.
Yeah, dropping out of medical school. I chickened out is the short of it. Chickened out, went back to med school, still really did not enjoy medical school. There was just sort of nothing that was speaking to me, and I still wanted to do all these other things. So when it came to the choice of a specialty, I decided nothing had really, there were specialties I knew I didn't want to do, but no real specialty had kind of jumped out at me as this is what I want to do. So I decided that I was going to pick a specialty that would allow me to make as much money as possible and work as little as possible so I could do all the things that I wanted to do. This is not the right way to pick a specialty. So I picked ENT, did not like ENT either. So I went to residency, kind of hated residency. Until, so the way my residency was structured, we didn't get to our cancer rotations until late in our residency. And so it wasn't until I actually got to the cancer rotation that I thought, oh, this is actually kind of cool. The patients are neat. I like the patients a lot. The surgeries are long, complex, but really interesting. So for a kid who tried to quit 10 or 15 different times, I actually went on to do fellowship. And all of this crystallized in 2008, the first time I went to Liberia. I went to Liberia to treat head and neck cancer patients, and I walked down to the wards of the hospital that I was on and saw a ward of 20 different head and neck patients at different stages of recovery. And I thought, oh, this makes sense. This is what I've been training for 15 years to do. So if you're in the middle of med school and you want to quit, maybe you should quit. But if you don't, there may be some good things at the end of it.
Yeah, well, we have to thank you for saying all that, because I know a lot of us here have sometimes felt, you know, kind of down and not sure if we should continue. But reading your, you know, CV, we're like, wow, this guy really loves school. He really loves all of it. But, you know, you're like the rest of us and we just have to push through. So thanks for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, medicine is she's a jealous mistress. All time that you don't devote to something else, she wants. And, you know, if you don't love it, the number of people that I've spoken to who've gotten burnt out on it is, you know, it's incredible. So, yeah, I mean, take this, you know, most of us that went into medicine did it as sort of a path. You know, we went from high school to college to med school and on to residency. I encourage pretty much everyone, your deans might hate me for this, but I encourage pretty much everyone to take at least 1 year away from this whole path, to take some time to reassess what it is you're doing and why you're doing it, and if it is actually something you want to do, because it's not for everybody, and it's not even necessarily for every med student.
Since we're already in med school, is that possible to do after med school, but before residency?
So anything is possible. I took a few years off over the course of my time. I took the year off when I went to Singapore. So between first and second year of med school, I took a year off. I didn't take any time off in residency, but then I did two fellowships. And between the two fellowships, I took another year off, which is when I first went to Liberia. And both times, I was told by the higher-ups, told by the deans, told by my attendings when I was a fellow, that it was the stupidest idea ever. This is going to ruin your career. People are going to look at this interruption in your career as just evidence of you being flighty. I think that, you know, it's been 20 years. I think that has changed. There is more of an expectation that people do explore a little bit more. But the fact is, if that ruined your career, it wasn't the career you should be in to begin with. And I will tell you that every single one of the people who said to me, you shouldn't do this, once I decided to do it, came up afterwards and said, gosh, I wish I had done that when I was younger. So it's possible to do it. It's possible to, I don't know what it's like here in Iowa. It's possible to do it in the middle of med school. It's possible to do it afterwards. You have to have a good reason. You know, you have to, if you really want to stay in medicine, you have to convince residency directors that I wasn't just faffing about for a year, but it's worth doing.
Did you find your extra degrees, like your MPH and your PhD, to be adequate kind of time off from the medical world, or was that still pretty involved with?
Well, I went into those, I hate to use the word life-changing, but I'm going to use the word life-changing. The first time I went to Africa and did that, had that sort of epiphany experience of, oh, this is what I trained for the last 10, 15 years, that really did change the course of my life. And it really made me think, I don't just want to be, I don't want to use the word just, I didn't personally want to be a surgeon who devoted most of his time to work here in the U.S. and then occasionally would take a week and travel to, you know, resource-constrained settings. I wanted that to be actually part of my life. So getting the MPH and then later on getting the PhD was an intentional desire to kind of move in that direction as opposed to just delivering clinical care in one place.
Yeah, so your PhD is in decision-making science, is that right? Tell us a bit about that as it relates to end-of-life decisions.
So the PhD is a PhD in health policy. And it was a PhD, in contrast to what I'm actually doing right now, is a PhD in domestic health policy. It was a fascinating time to do a PhD because it was right when Obamacare was being voted into law. So there's a lot of discussions around health policy. Within my PhD track, within my PhD program, there were a number of tracks, one of which was decision sciences. Decision sciences is a weird hybrid field. We're kind of wannabe statisticians, wannabe economists. We borrow from each of these fields, and we have our own fields. We have our own fields of decision theory and how to mathematically model how people make decisions. If you ever read a cost-effectiveness analysis, that's the most common output of a decision scientist is cost-effectiveness analyses. There's a whole bunch of other things that we do. But if you've seen a cost-effectiveness analysis, then you've seen a decision science paper published. That's what first drew me into it. I did my first cost-effectiveness analysis my second year of residency and quite liked it.
What were you doing a cost analysis during residency for?
We were looking at when patients present to the emergency room having swallowed a fishbone, the standard of care has been to get an x-ray to see if you can see the first examine the patient. And if you don't see anything on examination, then get an x-ray to see if you can see the fishbone. And then if you don't see it, then there's a lot of, you know, gnashing of teeth about, well, do we get a CT scan? Do we take him to the operating room? Do we just send him home? So that was the question that we wanted to answer, was what should you actually do when somebody comes in? The positive predictive value of of x-rays is something like 20%. So we wanted to see if there was a way that we could actually streamline diagnostics for patients who come into the emergency room complaining of having swallowed a fishbone. And it turns out that you shouldn't be doing an x-ray to begin with. You should probably take them directly for CT scan, unless you have a high suspicion, in which case you should just take them to the operating room. But in general, you know, where I was training at that point, we stopped doing x-rays after that and moved to CT scans.
Right on. Sorry to derail you there.
That's okay.
Why don't you just like stick a scope down and try to see the fishbone?
Okay. Oh, you absolutely do. Yeah. So that's part of, for an ENT, a scope is just part of our exam.
Okay.
So all this is if you don't see it on scope.
What's the incidence of swallowed fishbones?
So among patients, this is old data. This was data from Taiwan. Among patients presenting with complaints of having swallowed a fishbone, only 14% of them actually have fish bones on radiographic examination.
The others have fake fish bones.
No, what happens is they've probably all swallowed something and it scratches on the way down. The throat doesn't feel that as a scratch. The brain interprets that as, oh, there's something stuck in here.
So it's long gone by the time we get there.
Yeah.
Some psychosomatic fishbone pain.
A neurological case study.
When I was little, I was scared to eat fish because of the fish bones.
Yeah,
me too.
I thought I would swallow.
Yeah. Well, if you do now, you know that you should get a CT scan.
Made my parents very angry growing up.
So that cost analysis sparked you to get that PhD?
It sparked my interest in this sort of decision making, right? It's neat to be able to take a problem and say, well, here's how you should be acting. So it sparked that kind of interest. And then that interest grew, it melded with my interest in global health into a desire to want to apply that sort of methodology, not just to individual interventions, should we do a CAT scan or an X-ray, but instead to apply that methodology to actual policies that people are trying to decide between when trying to increase access to surgery, when trying to increase, you know, pneumococcal vaccination, all these sorts of things. Policymakers have to make decisions. And just like doctors have to make decisions, and we can analyze those, we can apply that same technique to the higher level policy decisions.
That's an awesome segue, because my next question was going to be about the surgery and global health that, you know, you've written the articles about. And so one of my questions there was that when we think about surgeries, the first things we think about is, oh, it's expensive. And so the first question is, how are people in these countries, how do we make these surgeries affordable for them? But not only that, how do we make it so that it doesn't cost at the expense of, you know, the doctors performing it or the system, or someone's not losing out because we're making surgeries cheaper for people? How do we do that?
You have about four questions in your question, which is good, but I'm going to turn it back on you.
Okay.
When you say surgery is expensive, what do you mean?
I don't know. It just seems like an impression that we have, at least in our American system, the surgeries seem to be quite, like, you know, pretty costly.
And that there's a lot of infrastructure that goes into to making a surgery happen.
And everything. Yeah.
Well, can't just give out vaccinations, you know.
I think we think of the technology that is used in the OR here. And we think of, like, the OR time and the resources, all the staff. That's used in
surgery.
The
temperature.
I'm going to split your question up into two and answer them both, or maybe ask you, press you on both of them.
Great.
So one,
he's ready.
One way to split it up is, or the two halves, one is surgery expensive to the system, and two is surgery expensive to the patient.
Exactly.
I think those are two completely separate questions. So let's start with the first one, the expense of surgery to the system, because I think that's actually where most of the pushback against surgery from the policy world comes. And I am not going to argue with you that surgery is expensive, but so is the development, so is research in HIV, so is research in vaccinations. It's all expensive. So being afraid of expensive, I think, is the wrong way of looking at it. What you could say to me, what you should say to me, is we get the sense that surgery is too expensive. And that sense is there. And I'd ask you, what do you mean by that? What do you mean by surgery being too expensive?
Well, I mean, the first thing I just thought of was, like I said, the system here. And when we think about procedures that are done, the cost seems to be really high, and insurance, like, you know, covers most of it. But I don't really know how it works in other countries, so maybe...
But even here,
yeah,
by claiming that something is too expensive, that we shouldn't be focusing on it because it's really expensive, you're implying some sort of line of something crosses this line, it becomes something that we should just not pay attention to. And my question is, how do you define that line? And I propose that, expensive or not, a Big Mac is more expensive than a cheeseburger, right? If you're hungry, you might buy a Big Mac, because you make the internal decision that the added benefit that I'm going to get from that Big Mac is worth the added cost, right? It's more expensive. I could go cheaper, but it's worth it to me to go more expensive. Same thinking with surgery. Surgery is expensive, just like HIV research is expensive. We've decided, though, that HIV research is a worthwhile investment. And the reason that we've decided that is because the cost for a year of healthy life that you can get from an HIV treatment, it's about $450. So it costs us about $450 to buy a year of healthy life from HIV patients, or for HIV patients, from the antiretrovirals. And we've said $450 for a year of life that's appropriate, right? HIV treatment is expensive, but it's good value. because I get a lot of benefit for that expense. The same thing can be done with surgery, should be done with anything you're deciding. And with surgery, the numbers for a year of healthy life are all $350 and below. Some surgical interventions are at the same value level as things like bed nets for malaria. So yes, 100% it's expensive. It is expensive to the system, but it is worthwhile if we're going to be consistent with ourselves. If we're going to say that we're willing to pay $450 in HIV, we should be willing to pay $450 in surgery, and we won't even have to because it's lower than that. The overall cost to fix the surgical system in low and middle income countries over 15 years would be $350 billion, which is a big number. But the cost in GDP losses to each of these economies, if we don't do anything, is $12.3 trillion. So it's a bit of a no-brainer that you should actually invest that to get that sort of return. So that's one side of the question. The second side of the question, which is surgery is expensive to patients, actually that's the part that fascinates me the most. This is where my research focuses.
So how do we start convincing these countries or these places that it's a worthwhile endeavor to invest in surgery?
Yeah, that's the $12.3 trillion question, isn't it? I think the convincing has to happen on a number of levels. In the end, the person who holds the purse strings in most countries is the Minister of Finance. And the Minister of Finance cares about what his or her bottom line is. And so an argument like this one that I just made, that you're losing 2% of your GDP to surgical conditions, you're spending a ton of money on malaria, which only impacts 1% of your GDP, is an argument. But I think it also, that argument has to be made from a human rights standpoint. That argument has to be made from the fact that health has been defined as a human right, and health is defined as a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being. It has to be made from a tug at the heartstrings argument. You know, we don't tell the story of surgery very well yet. I think it has to be made from sort of all three areas. I say this sometimes when I speak. If I walked up to you guys and I said, hey, I've found a new country over there, and I'm working on building the health system for this country, and I think I can keep my population healthy without doing surgery, you would wonder what I was smoking, and you would never sign up to be a citizen of that country, because we inherently believe that surgery is essential for us, and yet we somehow think, well, it's kind of icing on the global health cake later on.
One really great point I thought you made in one of your New York Times articles was how when you build up the infrastructure for to be able to do surgery, that benefits the society at large for other reasons as well. Have you experienced any of those examples of that in part of your work?
Yeah, that argument is an argument that I firmly believe is true and have no evidence for. This is an aspirational argument because we honestly, we're so early in this field of global surgery that we can't point to having built up the surgical system in any one country. We applied for a large grant a year and a half ago or so to do that in one, to funnel a ton of money into one sub-Saharan African country to build up the surgical system. That country had fewer than 20 hospitals that did surgery, so we could build it up and then measure the knock-on effects like you're talking about. I firmly believe that they're there, right? Because surgery requires things like electricity and water and suction and oxygen. And if you build that in a hospital, then you've got that for everything else. But I have no evidence for that yet. Mm.
That would even further cement that calculus you were doing on the cost benefit.
Yeah. There's also other things to consider, right? If you build these things, you'll need to maintain them, right? So maintenance comes into play. I grew up in Sudan, and I've seen all of these amazing people who come and work for the UN for quite some time. It comes with well intentions, right? These people want to help, but realistically, they come and go. Is there a path to build something that is self-sustaining, something that works on its own, and not just provide medical treatment or preventive treatment or just surgical treatment, just a self-sustaining healthcare system, in opposed to...
I think that's a spectacular question. We didn't develop the U.S. medical system with Chinese surgeons flying in for 2 weeks and doing stuff and maybe sending their old microscopes to us and then leaving, right? And yet we again, a bit of hubris. We feel like, well, that's the way we need to do it in Sudan. And I understand the reason for that, right? You know, as surgical systems develop, you know, they do it slowly and patients are left behind in that, and that feels, that doesn't feel right. But I think you're 100% right that that the solution to this is not just flying in, doing stuff, and flying back out again. To some degree, the solutions have to come from ministries of health, ministries of finance. They have to say this is a priority. And that's hard because ministers of health and finance have competing priorities, right? They've got, Madagascar was a country I was in 2 years ago, and the minister of health is a surgeon there and was really interested in building up the strength of his surgical system in Madagascar until he has the second worst rate of malnutrition, and now he's got the plague. So, right, surgery is going to obviously go by the wayside. So there's sort of that difficulty, and that has to happen at the ministry level. And also for those of us who work in global health and who work in development, we also need to own the mistakes that we've made in our past and turn that around and say, yeah, just flying in and doing some surgery isn't going to be enough. If I give you a microscope, I need to make sure I give you a microscope and a maintenance contract, and I need to train the biomed tech who's going to be able to maintain that. I need to give you a microscope that can be repaired from parts that you can buy at the car shop. And there's a recognition of this. This has been a slow dawning recognition, but it is a recognition that that the way we've been doing development in surgery hasn't really worked. Part of the reason we've been doing it, this is self-centered, but part of the reason we've been doing that is that in general, surgeons get 2 weeks of vacation a year. So it's really hard for a surgeon in the U.S. to devote any more than a week or two to a country, which is not to say that that's the right thing to do. What it is to say is that the surgical community in higher income countries here in the U.S. and elsewhere needs to come to grips with the fact that the medical folks have figured this out, right? You can make a career in HIV in sub-Saharan Africa as a clinician in the U.S. We can't do it in surgery yet. And I think that change needs to happen from our side as well.
Well, you bring the issue of time off that we only have, let's say, I'm interested in surgery. I would like to do cardiothoracic surgery. I think that no one will ever tell me what to do with my time. My time is mine. I grew up in Sudan where time is my thing. So if I want more than 2 weeks, I feel like I should be able to get that. Does that make sense?
Do you plan to work in the U.S.?
I do think I will work in the U.S., but I feel like I would be... Because my uncle's a cardiothoracic surgeon, and he tells me the same things. I don't have time off, but then I just told him about going to Nepal and to Camp Everest, and suddenly he have 10 days off or thing. But the point is that I feel like we are in charge of our time. We decide what we want to do with it. If that makes sense, I feel like we can make that choice. I don't think someone can tell me what to do with my time, regardless of who they are. Does that make sense?
It makes sense.
So
in an idealistic world.
I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you why, and I'll be completely frank with you.
Yeah.
You're not wrong at all. I think if you decide to open up a private cardiothoracic practice, then you're absolutely right. If you end up in an academic center where you're reporting to a chairman, then your time isn't necessarily yours because your chairman is interested in the number of cases you do and the number of RVUs that you bill and whether at the end of the year your line item on his budget is positive or negative. That's honestly what he or she is going to care about. And so there are ways around that. I've negotiated into my contract that this is part of what I do and this is the time frame that I do it. But I had to negotiate that into my contract, and my contract is very different from the contract of most of the ENTs that I work with. So to a large degree, you're right, but you have to be very intentional about making that true. Because otherwise, at this point, the surgical world hasn't come to grips with the fact that we've got to find ways to make careers in global health actual careers.
So as part of your contract negotiations, how much time do you spend abroad?
I spend 2 months abroad, 2 one-month blocks abroad. And then that's where I do most of my surgery, all of my surgery at this point. I see patients one day a week in the US, and the rest of my time is spent in research and policymaking around this field.
And what surgeries do you find yourself doing most in low income or resource poor settings?
So I'm a head and neck cancer surgeon. So I do almost exclusively head and neck tumors, mostly benign, because honestly, with a lack of access to care, most of the malignant tumors don't survive. So it's mostly benign tumors that I take out. But as any global surgeon will tell you, sometimes you're doing things that you didn't think you could do. I amputated a foot last year. I revised a VP shunt last year. But most of the time, 95% of the time, it's up in the head and neck.
So I imagine practicing in the U.S. is quite different than practicing in the various countries you've been in abroad. Do you see differences in malpractice? What does that look like for you when you practice abroad? Because I think when we think of surgery here in the U.S., like Tony mentioned earlier, we think expensive, but we also think of lawsuits.
Yeah, very different. There is a feeling that the surgeries that I get to do very much feel like medicine the way it was intended to be. You get to, you've trained for 2 decades to do something, and that something wasn't figuring out your billings and your charting and charting rights that the lawyers don't get, that all that stuff that we end up having to learn here after you're done with your residency and your fellowship. You did your residency and your fellowship so you could learn how to operate and you could learn how to treat patients. And that is so much more of what I do in resource-poor settings than what I do here. The regulations and the rules are necessary, right? They are absolutely necessary for efficiency, for, the bad apples that do spoil the bunch. Fraud does exist. Malpractice, true malpractice does exist. And so those rules and regulations have to be there. Do I personally feel like we may have gone a little bit too far to one end? Yes. But no, I don't think we could ever do away with all of them.
So you mentioned that you went into ENT because you wanted to make a lot of money. And then you had an epiphany when you were in a country in Africa. When did you decide to make global surgery a part of your career permanently, and how did that come about?
So I came back from my first stint in Africa, my stint in Liberia. After 6 months there, went back to do my second fellowship. And then I got a job as an academic head and neck surgeon in Boston, and was at that job for just under 3 years, and continued to go back for 2 weeks at that point at a time to West Africa. Was talking to a mentor of mine there about things completely unrelated to job choices. And he said that the way he makes big decisions in his life, if he's at a crossroads, he looks 30 years down the line at the best possible outcome of that crossroads for each of them. And if the best possible outcome makes him think, well, then it's not the right path for him. Because if you're not inspired by what you're working towards, all the ups and downs that you face along the way, they're just going to kill you. So I came home and looked at the best possible outcome of the next 30 years of my life as a full-time practicing head and neck surgeon. And I would have treated a few thousand patients. Half of them would have lived, half of them would have died, because that's head and neck cancer. And I would have retired with a nice car and a nice house. And that just didn't do it for me. And I struggled for a while because my partner there at the hospital, this, like, providing a good life for his family and being a good surgeon, those really drove him. And I genuinely don't think he was hiding anything. I think that was his genuine motivation. And I realized that it wasn't for me. So it took about 3 years for me to gather up the courage to actually make that jump. But that's how that jump happened.
So kind of going off of what you said there, for some of us who are thinking about careers in global health, how do we navigate it when we have a partner who isn't necessarily interested in global health? Like I know I have like family or other like people that I've been with who weren't necessarily interested. So how do we kind of like move around that or, I don't know, take them along or maybe, I don't know, what do you think?
So yeah, I was referring to my academic partner and so we, you know, I moved on to a different job. So okay. He's still there and doing great. I don't think any job is worth, you know, killing a relationship for. If you're in a good relationship with your family, with your spouse, boyfriend, girlfriend, I still think that trumps everything else. But people do change, and sometimes the change comes with experience, with experiencing that thing that you are passionate about. So if there's somebody that you're thinking of and they haven't been with you on a trip, then take them. But also it requires a fair amount of imagination, right? You can imagine yourself doing global health, but your partner needs to be able to imagine him or herself doing something that inspires them there also. Because otherwise you're going to just have this sort of push-pull that is one of you guys is going to win. And you know, when one person wins in a relationship, the relationship does not win.
That's great advice. Thanks.
It was very broad advice.
No, it was good.
So it seems like a big part of your career is addressing social inequities and health disparities. Do you find yourself involved in the political atmosphere as well? Or do you try to stay out of that?
Here in the U.S.?
Yeah.
I am unfortunately way too involved in the political atmosphere here in the U.S. The fact is, the things that I'm seeing in Madagascar, in Cameroon, Liberia, are things that we are moving back towards. And the Universal Declaration of Human Rights declares that health is a human right. This was reaffirmed is the word I'm looking for, reaffirmed in 1978. With the Almada Declaration from the WHO. All countries in the world have signed on to this. This idea that being healthy is a fundamental right of a human being. And I do think that, you know, as clinicians, we are tasked with protecting the rights of people who don't have the voice that we do. We get a voice because of the way medicine is viewed in the US, we get a louder voice than maybe we should be having. But we need to use that voice. I genuinely think we need to use that voice for good. We've been using that voice to a large degree to make sure we get paid well and maintain our status. And you know that I guess that's not wrong, but we do need to use our voice to make sure that those that can't speak can. So yeah, I'm unfortunately very involved in this. There's a sense that all doctors, that medicine in general, all we exist to do is line our pockets. The only bad review I have on Yelp is a review in which I was accused of offering surgery to somebody who had a mass in their throat, offering surgery to them so that I could line my pockets. So there is this view that we exist to enrich ourselves. And I think that's the first thing we need to do is start to bridge this divide between patients and doctors. There is, from both sides, there's distrust and there's disdain. Right? There's distrust from the patients towards us. And sometimes we view the patients with disdain. And that's not good on either side. And it is, I think, you know, the onus is on us to start bridging that gap and showing, look, I've got your back. I, as your doctor, have got your back. I want this to be better for you.
What are other ways that you engage politically? You mentioned...
Does Twitter care?
I think today it does.
I am only peripherally involved in the Medicare for All discussions that are happening, mostly because most of what I do is global health. You know, about 2/3 of my research is global health. 1/3 of my research is domestic, and the domestic research does focus again on this, the fact that healthcare costs worsen income inequality here in the U.S. 62% of bankruptcy in the U.S. is due to healthcare bills, and that's just getting worse and worse. And so, from a research standpoint, is at that point is as far as I go with that.
Are there any other issues that you've been involved in recently?
If you do follow me on social media, I rant and rave about gun control, but yeah.
Yeah, of recent events, I suppose.
Well, yes.
So I know in your article you were talking about surgery as the neglected stepchild of global health.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, in your work abroad, have you seen any other fields that you might also consider neglected stepchildren also?
So this phrase, neglected stepchild, is a phrase that I don't love. It's a phrase that Paul Farmer and Jim Kim coined in 2008 in a paper in the World Journal of Surgery. It is a neglect, surgery is a neglected stepchild to the degree that the funding streams and the attention hasn't been paid to it, but not to the degree that surgeons aren't involved in global health. There are 403 charitable surgical organizations working in global health right now. So it is neglected only because we're not talking about it, but it's definitely there. One of my friends is fond of saying that if surgery is a neglected stepchild of global health, then anesthesia is his imaginary friend. And I think that's true, right? It is to some degree silly that the Lancet Commission on Global Surgery was named the Lancet Commission on Global Surgery and not Global Surgery and Anesthesia, because we can't do what we do without them and vice versa. And then I'm going to give you a biased answer to that, because I do think the other thing that's neglected in global health, especially in global surgery, is any sort of rigorous research. We don't even think about that right now. We think about all these things that we can do, these ways that we can do good things, without ever really evaluating if these things are actually doing good.
So piggybacking off of that, I know for some of us who are interested in global health, but we might be interested in a field that isn't, you know, popular or mainstream within the global health realm, like, you know, HIV or infectious med. So how do we, you know, go out with the fact that we want to do something across the world, but in a field that isn't really talked about much in the global health sphere? How do we do that?
Is there a particular example that you're thinking of?
Possibly neurology.
Possibly neurology. Okay. All these fields, you know, there is work being done in all these fields. There's actually a current commission. It's underway now. I don't know when things are going to get published, but a current commission on global neurosurgery and is involving global neurology as well. Again, getting back to what I was saying to you before, you know, we didn't grow the U.S. health system in a vertical fashion, right? We grew it pretty horizontally. And I think there's more, even in the last 10 years that I've been working in this field, there's more and more room for recognition of the need for neurology, the need for neurosurgery, the need for cardiac care, even though all of these things, maybe not neurology as much, but all of these things tend to be expensive, but also tend to give you a lot of bang for your buck. That said, what I would say to an individual is, and this is what I say to all my ENT residents, is if you're interested in, as an ENT resident, going into global health, choose your subspecialty wisely. Because ENTs are, to a large degree, we are technology dependent. Sinus surgery is done endoscopically. Ear surgery requires lots of microscopes and is starting to be done endoscopically. You want to be able to do surgery as a surgeon so that when a foot that you have to amputate comes in front of you, you kind of can know how to do that. I don't know what the subspecialties would be in neurology, but I would think strongly about how you subspecialize in neurology such that you're still broadly applicable to wherever you end up going.
I'm wondering, you know, it seems like you have had a very impressive career. You know, we read your CV, we prepared for this, but I think, you know, how do you find time for self-care and, you know, taking care of yourself and, you know, being re-energized to go back at it the next day?
It's a really good question. A couple of answers. First of all, my 2 months every year, 1 month every 6 months, back in sub-Saharan Africa doing surgery, treating patients, is the single most centering time of my year. It reminds me why I'm doing all the research and the policy and the arguments and the emails, because those do tend to sort of drag on you. I would recommend to anybody, and you think you don't have time for a hobby, but you need to have time for a hobby. You need to have time for something that takes you away from what you're doing all day, every day, that even for an hour just sort of shuts your brain off. And it doesn't matter what it is. I mean, it's climbing a Ninja Warrior for me, but it could be cooking. It could be working on cars. It could be something. You have time for it. That neural pathway is still going to be there for you to study the next morning. And then I do think some measure, and it sort of depends on what your spiritual tradition is, but some measure of mindfulness, whatever that means to you, is super important, because as I said at the very beginning, medicine is this jealous mistress. She'll take over any time that you give her. And so you kind of need to set aside that time. And if it's 10 minutes a day, this is just for me to be. And we don't respect that as much as we should during medical training and during medical practice.
Yeah, I think that's great advice, especially when we think about physician burnout and a lot of the mental health stuff that's really, being focused on now in our curriculum.
Yeah, no, it's very important.
Awesome. Well, that is our show. Thank you, Dr. Shrine, for joining us. And thank you, listeners, for making us a part of your week. If you like what you heard today, leave us a review on iTunes, or you can talk about it or just about anything you like on our Facebook group, the Short Coats Student Lounge. Use it as a place to share questions with us, ideas, resources, recommendations, and memes or whatever. And you can also send those things to theshortcoats@gmail.com or leave a message at 347-SHORT-CT. The show is made possible by a generous donation by Carver College of Medicine student government and ongoing support from the Writings and Humanities program. Our executive producer is Jason Lewis. Our opening music is by Dr. Vox, and our closing music is by Catmosphere. Talk to you in 1 week.